Oh. Good evening to all of you. Welcome. We already have Mangala Charan. This beautiful kirtan. Kirtans by Radha Priya. So all the necessary invocations for blessings and divine presence of guardian angels are already in place. So today we are having what's called sometimes Ishtagoshti, or basically what we would like to call Q&E, or quest and exploration, where each one of you is invited to bring your heart, bring your paradoxes, bring your doubt, bring your questions, your passion, your longing for further depth, for further breadth, for further spaciousness to integrate the paradox that life is. We're talking today about paradox. I hope you had a nice Lectio Divina, thinking about Achintya Vida Vida Tattva. The totality of reality is a paradoxical, simultaneous, paradoxical coexistence of apparent opposites, unity and diversity. Yeah. So, I mean, the question that doesn't necessarily need to be in connection to the topic, but everything is in connection to the topic, so it's fine. So, Manjuali has a question. He didn't raise a hand, but somehow something.
Because at lunch I said that I had a question about paradox and about understanding how to approach paradoxes. And there's the whole thing about Krishna's a little boy being tied up by Mother Yashoda, but Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and is the most powerful. So the whole paradox, the whole idea of paradox and Achintya Vedavedita Tattva simultaneously one and different. So in my Lectio Divina, I took it into prayer today and really sat with it. And what was really came out was that Chilashita Maharaj, it's one of his favorite instructions was change your angle of vision. So when I found that, when we look for a linear answer or we look for something that is logical, then it doesn't necessarily meet up with the bigger reality. And so I just took a few notes of what came up in, because my question was kind of answered in my prayer work today, but I thought to share what I received. My question really was that in paradox, we have to the ground that we base, the foundation that we base our reality on is a solid place. But actually, when I look at paradox, it's a fluid place. It's the multidimensional place where I understand that Krishna and the realm of spirit is not of the matter form, though it is in the matter form. And what came was that we have to shift our perspective and look for truth in metaphors. And the metaphors, the paradox can be a pointer towards a deeper metaphorical truth. And then I just kind of went deeper and I saw that we have to seek inner wisdom by turning inward. We have to understand that actually our place in this material world and in reality is not made by just form, but that the wisdom comes by just sitting with the paradox and allowing it to reveal itself in the bigger picture. And then I really just dug a little deeper, and I found that actually, or what came to me is that paradox is a lesson in spiritual involvement or in spiritual growth, and to view paradoxes as a gateway to understanding the insights, and not as an obstacle to our progress. So actually, not that paradox was an obstacle, but paradox seemed to be uneasy because it's beyond the ground that we are accommodated or we listen to. And that actually through spiritual practice, through introspection, through finding a master that actually can see the bigger picture, then we actually paradox is just one of the elements of the bigger picture that shows us that the divine is beyond form and beyond the constraints of material linear thinking and logical thinking. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yes,
Okay.
that's my answer. Home, yes.
And what I also just really wanted to say is that paradox is a positive. It's not a negative. It opens us for questioning. It opens us for growth. It opens us for looking at the whole experience of our spiritual journey in a multidimensional way. And that is the gift of paradox, because it's not linear or logical. So that was kind of my question that got answered in prayer.
Thank you for sharing the question and the answer.
To add on to that, a question for you.
Sorry again.
And that to add on, that's what I received, but to add on, to embrace paradox is not an easy journey. To embrace duality or that it's uneasy because of our conditioning. So do you have any thoughts on helping us to allow paradox to be and allow us to not get use it as a roadblock? Yeah.
Any advice to that? How was my morning class?
In your morning
Yeah,
class. Okay.
let's add a footnote to
Like any little bits.
that. Yeah, the thing is that in one sense, paradox cannot be boiled down to a like a magical tip to deal with paradox, right? Because if not, it means that we are trying to make paradox not paradox, right? Like to put paradox into a box, right? Yeah. And you mentioned duality at one point, like if I understood correctly, as kind of coexisting with paradox is not easy, and then you say coexisting with duality is not easy, but I will not compare one to the other. I won't say that paradox means duality.
And duality,
Yeah,
both
exactly. So,
sitting next to each other.
yeah. So paradox is, in one sense, it's more challenging that coexisting with duality is challenging enough
Yeah.
because it's divided, war, fragmented, and that's challenging. But then accepting that there is duality and there's non-duality,
Yeah.
it requires even more harmonizing capacity, so to say. So it's challenging for sure, but it's a necessary challenge. That we need to grow. Again, we need to grow, and one of those challenges are advancing in our paradoxical way of seeing things. And I appreciate that you started by mentioning this line of Srila Siddhar Maharaj that I never get tired of sharing myself, which is change your angle of vision, which is another way of saying think outside of the box, which is another way of saying embrace paradoxical thinking. He may not have used those words, but the essence is the same, right? Try to change your angle of it. Try to dare to explore a different perspective. Dare to see things from a different perspective. And reality looks way different from other perspectives. You know? I always remember, and this was a very experiential, literal, somatic way of changing my angle of vision, which was when I did Dandabad Parikram to Govardhan. I was changing my angle of vision in every sense, literally, physically, mentally, right? Spending 2 weeks on the floor, basically. Right? So that changes your angle of vision because you spend 3 hours like this. So you start to see everything from another place. So that's why the famous prayers of Brahma, Parabrahma, is saying, Jnana Prayasa Modapas Jnana Mantaeva. Maybe the famous verse of his Brahma Stuti. He said, Jnana Prayasa Modapas, reject completely Jnana Prayasa. Prayasa means, like Rupa Goswami, we say, Tyahara, Prayasascha, Praja, six obstacles to bhakti. Prayasa means like what we will call now hoarding. So now he's saying Jnana Prayasa, no? Knowledge hoarding. No? Udapasya, reject completely. Like the excessive dependence on what's going on from the neck up. Do not become addicted to try to filter all of reality through your intellectual capacity. Instead, namantaeva, namanta. Namanta means namaste, namaskar. Do this. Instead of this. Seeing everything from this perspective. Like this famous picture of Michelangelo, right? When God is trying to touch Adam, representing us, and he's like, I don't know what to do, calculating. So Brahma says, rather than that, yeah, you can try to know things through your mental capacities, and there is a merit in that to some degree, there is a reach in that to some degree, but in connection to the infinite, you have to know when to surrender those faculties, and that's Namanta. Put your head on the ground, and by changing that angle of vision, you will gain way more knowledge from that perspective than from trying to conquer, colonize everything through your rational faculties. Because reality is not rational at the end of the day. It's not irrational either. It's just transrational. No, it can be rational on one level, but when you scratch the surface and dig enough deeper, it's no longer rational. Only it's transrational. So we need to adopt the transrational method to understand that. So yeah, change your angle of vision. That's very deep. There's so much there. Try to change your angle of vision. Try, you know, he say try, like implying. Good luck with that. Because the more when you try to change your angle of vision, you will start to see things that are new and are not familiar, and many times again we may just want to run back to the safety of certainty, but we need a new angle of vision. So again, to grasp the totality of reality, you know, we don't want to just to we want to. I mean, officially we say we want to love Krishna, we want to develop love for Krishna. But as I always like to say, loving Krishna means loving the totality of reality. Because nothing exists separate from Krishna. So you want to love Krishna and all whatever exists in connection to him. So we want to fall in love with reality. But we want to fall in love in an absolute way. There was reading this book from Ilya Delio that Jivan Prabhu lent, well, gifted me. Is it for me? Okay, thank you. That's not fair. Small book, but beautiful. Beautiful. Now I want to write to her and express my gratitude. At one point, she said that, like, the life's challenge is not to fall in love, reality, but to fall in love in an absolute way. No? Because sometimes we use this word, I fell in love. With whom? With one person. Okay, good to begin with. But to fall in love in an absolute way, means nothing is excluded from the picture. So how to do that? That sounds like a very almost like impossible task, right? No. And that's why she said that's life's challenge. That's another way of saying the goal of life. But goal again, it sounds like once I have it, it's the challenge of life. Because it's an ongoing. You can always fall more in love with the totality of existence. And again, to fall in love with God, with Krishna, the all-attractive, that's relatively easy. To fall in love with the totality of reality, which includes so much other stuff, which is still connected to Krishna, the messiness, the brokenness, all the things that are not very becoming, still somehow they hold some intrinsic connection to that all-attractive source. So how to fall in love with that? Where the outer presentation of that seems so unlovable. And that's starting at home. What to speak about? Anytime we have lots of difficulty with us, then try to multiply that to every single living entity around us. So it's a big challenge. So we need to change our angle of vision all the times necessary so we can finally fall in love with the totality of reality in an absolute way. I know that sounds very romantic, very like idealistic, but there cannot be any lesser goal than that. Any other lesser goal is still a partial treatment of reality. So that's the haunting question. How to fall in love with the totality of reality, especially those things that surround me that I feel not only I cannot fall in love with that, but I don't want to fall in love with that. I will never fall in love with that. I will forever hate that particular aspect of reality, that particular person, that particular aspect of me. It's hateful for eternity. I mean, I'm exaggerating, dramatizing a little bit, but sometimes it's like that and even worse like that. So yeah, gradually falling in love with the totality of reality. That's a call of love. That's invitation of love. It's not a partial love letter that we are receiving. In this sense, it's all or nothing. It's a gradual process, but it's all or nothing in the sense that in the sense of, I'm not saying that if you don't love the totality of reality, you don't love nothing, but I'm saying that the goal of that is all, to love all, to love the totality, in that sense. You asked for something that's what came. Other pre.
But I was actually just going to say thank you. I was going to say after singing that you are, from your tenderness, I'm able to express my in the congregation. You're the only, literally the only Western sannyasi that I
Should I pause the
explore.
recording now?
Pardon?
Should I pause the recorder?
Richard.
I may be embarrassed. I'm the only Western sannyasi.
I could
Pray for me.
well, also everyone you were saying about invoking the angels, and I think everyone to me was sounding, you're all angels. Now as and then I have something else I want to ask you about. Vulnerability comes in very different forms. I'm really vulnerable to say this, but In regards to what you're just speaking about, since I was a child, I love every living thing, every living being, every human being, every living thing, because I love the beautiful, eternal spark, the soul, and it's like I could see it, and that's the my focus. And I loved the person, even the really like person who's acting in very terrible ways, because actually deeper, 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 that person is actually a very, very beautiful, shining, totally lovable spark. And that person's only suffering and causing other suffering because the consciousness is so far away from their own beauty. So I wanted to tell you that, and then you can make a commentary.
was tricky. Commentary by Swami Padmanabh. Remind me Rasangi US questions, like she speaks it well. Do you have anything to say to that?
He said, he said, like with Jesus, to you hate the sin and not the sinner. And he said, but that is hard to do. I was telling him that's how I felt.
And of course, not only he says hate the sin, not the sinner, but then he comes and say love your enemy. That's the icing on the cake, so to say, right? Because we could it may be difficult enough not to hate someone and focus on the activity, but understanding the background of that, and but on top of that, to love beyond, scratch the surface till you find the lovable dimension. That's hard work. That's why, remember when Father Richard will say, actually Jesus, when he started his movement, so to say, the original plan was not that it will become a massive movement. Because if you really pay attention to what he's asking, not everyone will be willing to that. Of course, a massive movement may be there, but that doesn't mean that everyone is actually follow. No? And that's not only for Christianity, it's with every tradition. No, generally the minorities are the ones who are really willing to take it all the way, to the bottom, to the top, to every direction. Like to take it seriously and play the implications of what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be a Gaudiya Vaishnava, what it means to be a human being, how much of a human being can I be, and how much am I actually doing the necessary to fulfill that potential or not. And again, this is not to make anyone feel miserable, but just to be sobered by many times our falling short of the ideal. Not to get neurotic, but it has to be a sobering lesson to and a hopeful one, that despite whatever falling short, there's still another invitation. There's still a highest prospect, huh? That's a beautiful arrangement, because if we'll fulfill our ideal, actualize our potential like this, then that's frustrating. I was like, okay, no. So yeah, that's a great challenge. Like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, like a real sadhu yogi, he's speaking there. A sober person sees other people's suffering as one's own. You know, takes that, empathizes with that. So, and when you are seeing someone doing, and of course, we generally think about this as, okay, if I see someone crying, someone clearly suffering, I will connect and I will be there. But if I see someone committing violence, being hateful and abusing, I won't connect with that. Yeah, but behind all that, there is suffering. And you have to connect with which doesn't mean you are approving the distorted, how to say, playing out of that root suffering. It's not that I'm, how to say, supporting Hitler, supporting a dictator, supporting whatever, but behind the atrocity, there is suffering, and that suffering, because of not being properly addressed, creates so much suffering. I mean, those personalities who create suffering all around them, who seem to have obtained a PhD in as perpetrators, that speaks about how much suffering is in them. Again, this is not to justify anything, just to get a deeper understanding of the reality that is taking place beyond the surface. No? That's kind of the method that Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Roy had, though the conversation was somehow in another direction. But as we know, Mahaprabhu asked Ramananda Roy, what's the goal of life? He will say something. Mahaprabhu will say, "Ho bahya agya kaha," that's superficial, go deeper. He will say something else. He will say the same thing, that's superficial, go deep, augment that truth. That's still a partial treatment of reality, and go deeper. And in this way, not like guru and disciple, ideally the guide is inviting the student, like, even if that's a partial truth, that's not the end of the story. So in the same way, we can say, oh, such a guy is such a terrible perpetrator. Yeah, but that's not the final, the ultimate truth. Not only in terms of what lies behind that, but also what lies in the eternal prospect of that soul. And also in terms of the wonderfulness of the soul. So there are so many ways that you can dismantle, like, that situation, so to say, put it, deconstruct and reconstruct it in a way that now brings compassion into the picture. And again, I'm giving extreme examples of certain personality, but we just can just apply that to ourselves. Sometimes we hate ourselves more than any other person. Why? Okay, maybe you did something really unbecoming. Let's be honest, we are not saints, probably. So sometimes we hurt other people. But as the saying goes, hurt people hurt people. Yeah. So that's the threat. If you see people hurting other people. And I can remember, I don't know, when I was in the school, I generally didn't receive too much bullying. I was the tallest of the class, so generally that holds some weight. But even when you witness some of this, like, again, children who are not, like, consciously, they're just playing out the consequences of the unresolved stuff that they're receiving at home. I mean, generally, eventually those kids who were the bullies. I mean, you just need to look beyond the fence what's going on at home, and you realize that's their unprocessed grief, so to say. They are so, and they're just extending the unhealed wounds. That's why many times we say, that's a form of distorted parampara. You are passing on not a torch of light, but you are passing on something that you should work on yourself and pass to others the healing of that wound. Well, I mean, as a teacher, as a guru, as an anything, it's as a friend, as a partner, as a husband, as a wife, as a father, I mean, related to other people is passing on stuff constantly to each other. It's not just guru disciple. In any relationship, it's an ongoing passing on back and forth. So, and ideally, yeah, we should not throw on the other people and our unresolved stuff. Yeah. Maybe express our unresolved stuff. Of course, we will end up throwing on other people our unresolved stuff. That happens, but no, that's not the idea. It happens. But the more we gain awareness, the more we can pass to others the gift of the healed unresolved stuff. Which is a gift unto itself. It's not just I have to give you fancy, nice stuff. That's the only thing that you can pass on, no? Like pink color, nice smile, some whatever. So, I think that's very important, right? When we see and in your mind, different people may come to your mind again, you yourself may come to your mind, some person or some situation that we, how's in English, abhor, abhor, how do you pronounce it?
Or
Abhor. Still reminding ourselves what's behind that. Because many times in connection to all those things, we get angry. But as we say, behind anger, there's always some form of sadness. So if the other person is being angry, I was recently reading a very beautiful book, given by Manjwali. Today I'm talking about all the books that you are gifting me, and just to show that I'm reading them. I'm a good boy. Not that good, but at least I read the books that are given to me. So one of the books, the one written by Patrick Goodhouse, friend of common friend now that we got to meet a few days ago, and it's a book on Etty Hillesum. If you don't know about her, please know about her. She wrote a series of diaries about her experience in the during the Holocaust, basically. And those diaries came to the surface many years after her dying in the concentration camp. Actually, she died in Auschwitz, but they are very interesting. Again, I don't want to spoil the whole thing. I made the Swami reacts the other day about the book, so you will have the summary of it. But what I wanted to say is that she highlights there, of course, she's witnessing the horrors of the Nazi regime, and there is so much violence. I mean, I don't need to enter into the details of that. But she also highlights how her fellow Jewish people, she was Jewish, were filled with hate. And again, I don't want to condemn that. It's complex, right? I mean, we haven't been there probably, so it's difficult to just speak about something from something like that. But my point is that she, of course, she was not comparing one thing with the other, but she was just seeing, okay, there's so much hate and violence coming from the Nazi party, but I'm seeing that my fellow Jewish people are receiving that hate and feeling more hate even. And she entered into a particular, very interesting 2 years. She kind of became from being a very quote unquote normal person, if you want to put it that way, to became kind of a mystic basically. And she entered into this point of I refuse to hate. No, I refuse to continue playing that game, perpetrating the game, because it's feeding one same monster altogether, and it's just increasing the problem. And of course, that's easy for me to say it here, but you being in that situation, where you have all the best, quote unquote, best reasons in human history to hate, now you can really feel entirely justified to hate what's going on. She said, "I refuse to hate." And at one point she started to do this inner exercise of scratching beyond the surfaces and looking at all these Nazi soldiers that were abusing her and others, and seeing the bright side beyond the what? The horror movie. And seeing each one of them as a very fragile soul, full of fear, full of so many things that, but at the same time, full of brightness in their essence. And that's a very powerful exercise, right? Because in some situation like this, like, I don't see one single ray of light emanating from this person. How can you speak about the bright soul? It's just sheer darkness everywhere. Change your angle of vision. Change your angle of, I have changed my angle of it. Still, I see only darkness. Keep changing. There are not two perspectives only. Keep adjusting, readjusting, 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 till you start to see things beyond certain layers, right? And again, this is not a justification of abuse. This is not a passive acceptance of horrible things going on in society, as they are always going on something. It's not just about the past. And there's a place for social justice, there's a place for activism, there's a place for so many things. But also those things should be balanced by Like again, Richard Rohr will name his group Center for Action and Contemplation. Because if it's only action without contemplation, if it's only activism without an inner life, we become just hateful people acting in the world, but feeding anger, feeding hate, and not resolving our own inner warfare. Because again, there is war outside, there is conflict outside, there is violence outside, but all those things are inside of us on some degree. On some degree. And we have to have the integrity of working on all the things at home first. And again, that's easier said than done. It's easier to hate than to forgive. And it's easier to lose hope than to keep hope despite all. Like someone like Etty Hillesum had. She had all the reasons to lose hope. Like Viktor Frankl will also speak about his own experience, right? Those who lose hope and who gave up lose no more purpose in this. They died after a few days. So he, in a relentless way, he insisted. There is purpose. There's always meaning. There's always purpose. Love always outweighs, outgrows hate, abuse, anything. And again, I'm not talking this cheaply and sensitively if someone has been going through a very traumatic experience. But because of that, we need to hold on to something that is bigger of all the trauma put together that we may have gone through. Because if there's nothing beyond that, then what's the hope? Then we give up. So, again, it's not easy talk. I can speak blah 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 blah, but one then has to embody that, and that's very challenging. But that's the only thing we are invited to do at the end of the day, not to be talking all day about loving others, but embodying that. And embodying that again, beginning in a sustainable way, because if not, also we can feel overwhelmed by my falling short of universal love, so to say. So we shouldn't also like feel depressed because I'm not Vasudev Datta, no? When our tradition is asking Mahaprabhu, give me the karma of all living entities and I stay here paying for that and you take them all. The idea is not like you hear that story and feel so miserable that, oh, I'm not willing to do that. I'm such a, no, that's not the point of the story. It's a story that just shows the potential of everyone has. You can become that compassionate. Well, I'm miles away from that. Okay, but you can still become that compassionate. Don't underestimate your potential. Yeah, Dorothy Day. What did Dorothy Day say, Anuradha? You have been studying this line and gaining further context.
But you see, I
I
love
only,
God,
yeah.
not God as much as the person. I love the race.
Yeah. Okay, you hear that and it's like, oof, that, okay, Dorothy Day ki jai, but that's not me. Well, she's showing your potential. That can be you. Do not underestimate that. So, even in the falling short of our potential, still we should be reminded of all that we can be. Okay, I cannot be that forgiving. I cannot be that compassionate yet. I cannot love my enemy. I cannot love it all yet. But I know I can. It has been demonstrated by people in my life who at least show a deeper, broader degree of that type of love. So that's an hint that there is more to the picture. It's not that that person was born with some special stuff that I lack. Because sometimes we create those hierarchies in our mind. No, it's that those people are showing who all that you can be. So. Yeah. And again, even if someone breaks your heart or breaks your neck or wrist or anything. Breaks your heart maybe even more complex than breaking your neck. But still there is Still, there is a lesson there. Still, there is a growth waiting there. No doubt about it. Yeah, it may take time, may take years to make sense of that and to accept that, to integrate that, to fully forgive that. But yeah, and again, it all begins at home. Many times, if we have difficulties in forgiving, generally that's proportionate to how much difficulty we have in forgiving ourselves. Let's be honest, we have not entirely forgiven ourselves for what we have done, for who we are, or for who we think we are. And that's why I find it so healing to over and over again go back to, okay, even if you have not forgiven yourself, someone has already forgiven yourself from time without beginning. Not even that, because this is not that Krishna has forgiven yourself. He just loves yourself from time without beginning. So if you love someone fully, there's no even question of using the word forgiving, right? So trying to enter into that space, and yeah, I'm loved. So I'm fully loved, I'm lovable, and everyone else is. Let's not in Bengali they have this thing called Ardha Kukutti Nyaya, half hen logic. You know the story? It's a type of it's like a how to say it? Like a maxim. Maxim, the maxim of the half hen, which is a guy is feeding it having it's not a vegetarian vegan analogy, sorry for that. Includes a degree of violence, unfortunately, but anyhow, it's a no. The guy is feeding having hens in his feeding working with hens, feeding the hen, giving food to receive the eggs and to make a profit out of the eggs. And at one point the person thinks, okay. So one hole is giving me money, giving me X, but the other hole is taking my money because I have to feed that hole, right? So better I cut the head and I just remain with the other hole, which gives me money. That's a half hand logic. Of course, you cancel one, you cancel both. So in the same way, the half-hell logic here will be, oh, Krishna loves me unconditionally. Yes. And he loves everyone else, and so shall we. So shall you. Oh, no, I don't like that part. I only keep the Krishna loves me unconditionally. That's half-hell logic. Right? If I just want to keep that, but I don't make my best to extend that to others and to see that in others, by failing in doing that, or by not doing that, not even trying, I lose awareness of how I'm being loved. You follow my point? I cannot be completely aware that Krishna loves me and be completely unaware that Krishna loves everyone else. It's not possible. It's delusional if you think that's the case. Because we are interconnected, interrelated. So Krishna is not exclusivistic. I love this, I love that, I love that. That race, that color, that country, then it's funny how we humans create all the things, right? Like in the past, like I don't know, two armies go to war. Okay, let's pray God is on our side. But the other army thinking God is on our side, not in there. It's like and you are making God partial to whatever you want and you like. No? You are creating your own, that's idolatry, basically. No? You are worshiping a false idea according to your whims. So that feels comfortably to feed your dualistic mentality instead of thinking of God is for everyone. So yeah, that's the challenge. That's the challenge and that's the beauty, both things. Again, the beauty. You are being infinitely loved with God. Beautiful. Yes, but every beautiful thing, the most beautiful things are the most challenging things. Because God loves you unconditionally, beautiful. God loves everyone unconditionally as well, and you are supposed to do so. Challenging. But beautiful still remain. So beautifully challenging. Now, if we just want beauty without challenge, half-hand logic. And that's what most people want this for, right? They want beauty, enjoyment, whatever. But no challenge, no growth, no change my angle of vision. Just give me the egg, so to say, right? But you have cut the neck of the hen. There's no more of no possibility of having eggs. That's basic common sense, interestingly. So I'm not talking any super sophisticated esoteric wisdom here. It's just like math. You cut the hand of an animal, the neck of an animal is dead. Don't expect byproducts from something that has been killed, and you have killed it. So it's like killing the hen and then like complaining and feeling angry at the hen. Like, why are you not giving me eggs anymore? Why? Well, hens should be angry at you. You cut the neck, So the same way, Krishna loves me unconditionally, but at one point I don't feel the unconditional love. Why, Krishna? I don't feel it. Why you're not love? Well, he has nothing to do with that. It's because you are you're dividing something that is impossible to divide. We are living an impossible life, so. Yeah, we have to gradually extend that view, right? Love your enemies. You ultimately, there are no enemies. Everyone is worthy of compassion and understanding. And the soul is amazing. I mean, ontologically, metaphysically, what Krishna says, the soul is amazing. Every soul is amazing. Every soul is a unit of worth, a unit of lovability. And you should love that. Some other stuff that is being done under the influence of ignorance, that's another thing. But you should also love that. How? Feeling compassion for that. That's a form of love. If any of you do something horrible, I will love that. But in this sense, I will love that by feeling compassion for what's being done in such a condition. It's a form of love, compassion. So, strictly speaking, we have no excuse to stop loving at any moment. Love may take different forms, compassion, this, that, but in principle, Aitukiya Pratihata, Devatan says. Bhakti love is causeless and unbroken. So, if you connect with that current, it's unbroken. It never stops flowing, never stops embracing everything. Well, if you tune in, if you attune to the current of love, you will find this is always flowing, 24/7, always loving. Love is always love. Does not there's no doesn't take a holiday, basically. And when you love, you don't take a holiday from love. Like, oh, I'm exhausted of loving. Give me a weekend of hate or apathy and indifference. Give me a break. No, it's not. If you have a genuine connection with true love, that idea won't even cross your mind. So, yeah. So it's interesting how, yeah, I'm going back to Jesus, no? Don't hate the sinner, hate the sin. And even don't, it's not hate the sin, no? Because still, it may sound we are promoting hate. The point he was making is, try to make a discernment between these two. Don't merge the two entirely forever, because you will end up being the loser to begin with. Because who is free from missing the mark? Who is free from sin? If you put the two together, you start to become convinced I am that. The more you say they are that, that like boomerang that goes back to you, and whenever you do something like that, you will fall into the same thing. I over-identify with what I did, and then comes toxic shame, and it's not that I did something bad, I am bad. Yeah, sometimes I did something bad, it's good to recognize that and make amends. That's a word. But I did something bad. I is one thing, did something bad is something else. But if you say I am bad, oh, that's a problem. Because there's something bad in my own, in the core of my being, we can become so convinced of that. And then we do not become a unit of relief in the world, but the opposite. So Jesus say, discern between sin and sinner. Then he said, love your enemy. And then when his quote unquote enemies were killing him, he say, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing. So that's kind of an elaboration of what it means to love your enemy. Here you have an enemy. Imagine, try to put yourself for a moment in that situation. I'm killing you gradually, even worse, right? Because it's not like, poof, it's like, it's torture before they're dying, so to say. And you understand from where this is coming. This, you are not taking it personal. Oof, that's high level wisdom. Someone's killing you and you are not taking it personal. But you understand they are acting out of avidya. That's why he say they do not know what they are doing. That's what we call avidya, ignorance. You're acting out of your lack of vision, your lack of knowledge. And from avidya comes dvitiya, dualistic mentality, us and them mentality, black and white mentality, nothing to do with paradoxical thinking here. So from ignorance comes duality, from duality comes bhaya or fear, because I'm start to see separate groups. So we are not integrated, we are not one family, reality is not bonded together, but everything seems separated and isolated. That creates anxiety, fear, and then you develop the corresponding defense mechanisms to cope with that. And you multiply that a little bit and you become a world terrorist. But it all began with avidya. You just don't know what you're doing. Though you think you know, and you think this is the best thing you can do. Oh. That's why some people will say there is actually no such a thing as intentional evil. It's not that someone will say, okay, now I will do evil. You're actually convinced that's the best thing you can possibly do. Well, it's the worst. But you are in ignorance. So you are convinced this is the best way of carrying on with my life, and you're exterminating a whole species or whatever. No, that's the level that which we can be covered. So that's worthy of compassion, of crying over. Again, not as a passive thing and not doing anything apart from that, but part of the solution of all the things is learning, and we will talk about that in a few days, but learning to grieve over the things. Because again, behind the anger, there are tears. How many times behind excessive anger, there are excessive ungrieved tears. So not having learned to cry over what's worthy of being crying over make us a monster. But behind the monster, there's a fragile soul that needs to cry or needs to grieve and needs to connect with the situation from a place of sensitivity and tenderness. So, and like I was telling to someone, I think today, even, I think to Jivan after the morning's class, that recently I saw a documentary about this, like some of the main dictators in human history. Sorry, but yeah, I watch it. But I like to watch them to understand. I mean, not like I'm like, wow, this is so exciting, but the psychology behind that and what makes a human being to get to that place and how every one of us have the potential to reach there. So what should I not do to become that? And it was very interesting because all these men that most people will think they're the worst of the worst and this and that, we know their names again, the Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and this and that. All of them had absolutely dysfunctional childhoods and absolutely traumatic relationship with their father figure. whether it's if it was present or traumatized because it was absolutely absent. So again, going back, you see a fragile boy and baby, like, again, eventually they become human beings and they are taking decisions and they are responsible for that. I'm not saying just like, but you cannot cut that part also of the picture. So again, comes this paradox. No, you cannot just, okay, let's just see the fragile, traumatized baby and just, oh, poor you. No. But also not decontextualize the person from all that that made the person be that. So holding both things at the same time, that's not easy. Again, that's paradoxical. Justice, mercy, these two exist, right? There's place for both. But ideally not with, even if we speak about justice, not from a hateful place, not from a resentful, bitter place, not from a place like, I want to make you suffer. Again, like Gandhi will quote the Old Testament regarding this eye for eye, how to say, tooth for tooth. Tooth.
Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Yeah. So he will say, if we are to apply that to each one of us strictly, all of us will be blind and toothless. Right? So, I mean, like implying there is a place for that action, reaction, karma, and so on. But that's not the end of the story. That's the point. That exists on some level in some realm, has a purpose, but even that exists in the service of a bigger purpose. Right? So karma in itself is not just like a cold universal law for it, that exists for its own sake. In other words, I like to refer to karma as the law of reciprocity. No, not so much chastisement or this or that, but some particular universal codes that are there to teach us responsibility, reciprocity, with the intention that we gradually grow to become aware of the final responsibility, which is love. In love, you have the greatest responsibility. So karma exists in the service of love. Love. No, it's not its own thing. Just to eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, another eye, another tooth here. It's in the service of a bigger picture. So, yeah. Yeah. It requires lots of coherence and integrity too. Especially for us in a tradition where mercy is so emphasized, and mercy goes beyond justice. And we pray for mercy, and mercy is coming, and we may pray for mercy, but we have very careful not to pray for mercy, but not being willing to extend that same mercy to everyone else. Right? Again, half hand. Give me mercy. Why are you giving mercy to him? Huh? Such a rascal, that person did that, did this, and blah, 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 blah. But give me mercy, Krishna, please. I really need your grace. That's not coherent. Please. Yeah. Some thoughts, I don't know. You asked for thoughts.
My father is like the woman in the book.
Sorry, your father was?
Similar to the woman in the book.
At the Hillison.
Yes.
Okay.
His relatives were gas.
Yeah.
I won't tell the whole story, but he came to, through experience, came to not want to put that terribleness into the world for himself. Took the path into the heart. He didn't bring us up to blame even Hitler, but to say, like you're saying, that possibility is in within each one of us.
Yeah, and of course, not to limit the whole conversation to the Nazi Holocaust, but I say Hitler, but it's not that just it was just Hitler. I mean, there wouldn't be millions supporting him. You didn't have a Nazi Holocaust. If he would just be one person with his own ideas, blah, 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 but nobody cared for that. So it's a complex array and participation in different ways, and even saying all that at the end of the day, that's not the end of the story for anyone. So again, this is one frame of the whole picture.
Is it fair to look at the soul as pure innocence? Because the soul is pure innocence, right?
Again, that's what Krishna says in the Gita, not saying in this way, but again, he speaks about the soul and says, Acharya, but Acharya is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. But again, when we lose sight of our wonderfulness and by extension of everyone else's wonderfulness, you can end up doing all this stuff. So that shows the degree of how much distracted and covered we can be. But when we gain awareness of the wonderfulness of everything, again, we cannot but fall in love with the totality of reality. And that's why then you have verses taking it from the Nazi Holocaust to the other extreme, verse in the Bhagavatam, when you say, when you reach such a place, you see a dog and you will fall flat on the floor to offer your dandavat to a dog. And you will honor every speck of dust, and you will be careful not to step onto an ant, and you will be adoring, not even worshiping, but adoring every fiber of existence. That's possible. So again, here we have the two extremes of potentiality. Where and then of course is, what do you want? Red pill, blue pill, so to say, matrix language. Now, in which direction do you want to excavate your potential? Because we can go up without limits, or we can go down without limits. You can always fall lower, you can always rise higher. And sometimes we do a little bit of we explore a little bit the oscillation, up and down, up and down. But eventually, yeah, the soul is a unit of oneness, of wonder, sorry. Again, it's difficult to see that because many times we don't have a deeper experience of who we are. So then we tend to see us and everyone else according to who they are not. So if we show extreme judgmentalism and condemning others and putting people in, that only shows how little we have an experience of our own soul is amazing. Because the moment you start to enter in contact with the amazingness of your own soul, I mean, the experience is of such nature that you know this is not only about me, right? It's not like, wow, I am so amazing. No. No, the soul is so amazing, and everyone is a soul. So there's amazingness everywhere. So yeah. Again, not for anyone to feel bad or guilty about, oh, I'm still falling so short of that. But in a sobering, humbling way, there is place for that also. To be honest and not deceive ourselves about where we are on the journey. Because sometimes we can also think, I'm more advanced at what I am actually are. Because I know this verse, because I'm Maharaj, because I'm whatever. Again, as we said the other day, pride is very resourceful. You can become proud about anything. I'm the best. I'm the worst. You can become proud about anything. Prabhupada, I'm your most advanced disciple. Prabhupada, I'm the lowest of your disciples. No? You know that story. And Prabhupada said, you are not the most anything. Yeah. Well, don't try to be the most anything. It's not about being the most something. Be who you are and explore your potential. Yeah. Bhaktirasa?
Just a quick thing is, Cohen had said that the
Who?
crack, Cohen, the musician,
Leonard Cohen.
yeah, that the cracks are where the light comes in,
Yeah.
but it's also where the light comes out.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. You know the song? Sorry, you invoked the song. Hallelujah. Yeah. Sorry. You opened the crack and the light came in. You gave a second perspective. So he says, well, there is a crack in everything. That's where the light gets in. I was speaking about, yeah. And then you say, sorry, but Teresa.
The crack is also where the light comes out. You can see the light that shines within through the brokenness of it.
Yeah. Kintsugi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dharaneshri was raising her hand an hour and a half ago. What time is it?
It's a
Eight.
2 days ago.
Oh, yeah, sure is. Oh, yeah. Will it be now? Will it be now 4 days ago for the next? Sorry. I forgot you had a question from 2 days ago.
It's okay. It still will be there.
Know, but still, we can.
You want me to ask it now?
You want?
Okay. It sort of follows on, I think, from what you said in relation to Manjuali. And it maybe was partly answered by that as well. So in somewhere, I didn't bring the book, your EDL, and I can't remember where it is, but it's you were saying it in relation to an answer. I won't be able to find it, but thank you. Because it's been, I have an asterisk in my book. And lots of, but it's in relation to what you were saying about loving Krishna's in relation to loving the totality of everything. And you were mentioning that to Manjari. So we had a little discussion on our WhatsApp group. Because, and I wrote it to you as well that when I was reading Evolution and Divine Love and that particular quote, it struck me that when I think of the word love, it's easier to get a grasp of it than when I think all these years thinking of the word bhakti because it's a foreign word. Like I didn't grow up with Sanskrit, so bhakti was not as familiar. But when I was reading Evolution Divine Love, then I was grasping more concept of what love is. And we were discussing a little bit on the WhatsApp group. And then Jivana, he said something along the lines of, but it's
What did
not.
Jivan say? Now everyone's looking at him.
Correct me if I quote wrongly, but you said something, but yeah, but it's not just love, it's divine love. So that's, it's, you can't just say, oh, I understand it because it's love, it's divine love, and that's what bhakti is. So then I started thinking, after all these years, do I even know, is there a difference between divine love and love? And then, so then you said to Manjuali, quoting this person, that it's about expanding this love to make it absolute. So I guess the question is there just one love? Or is it
That's
divine?
another song. Now go from Leonard Cohen to Bob Marley. How the music, some scars from 30 years ago are still there, right? It's interesting.
Yeah, is there just one love and it's just a matter of explaining it to the totality of everything? Or is there divine love and another kind of love that's not divine? Or is that just misdirected divine love? Or too small divine love that hasn't expanded?
Course, these are only words, right? Love, divine love. I mean, we are trying to articulate these realities, which are, in one sense, ineffable. No, ineffable, beyond speech, beyond words. You can say something, but you can never encompass the totality of that. So I can speak about love all that as I quote in my book, right? When I before I tried to give a definition of love, which in itself sounds very bold. Well, how you dare to define love is kind of putting love in a box somehow. But at the same time, we have to say something about it, right? And there's this poem by Rumi where he says, I try to write the word love, not to define it, just to write it. And when I wrote, when I was about to write love, the pen broke. The pen resisted. Well, a love resisted. Final definition, closure. Well, just writing the word love what to speak defining. So these are words. That's what I want to say first. Love, divine love, and sometimes we may be using them interchangeably, and sometimes, I mean, of course, you ultimately love is divine love, but you ultimately divine love is not limited to God, right? So it's again, it's all the point is what we understand by the words. Because I can be saying word love, 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 divine love, love, divine love, but what's going on inside of you? That's the real what matters. So in one sense, both have to be understood as inseparable. I mean, if I love God, I love everything else. And we could say we may be loving on some partial level something without loving God, without love. But if we are to be strict in what's the full face of love, again, not the partial treatment of the word, that's when sometimes comes the thing, okay, is that love? Is that not love? If you, I don't know,
You love your child,
if you love your whatever,
your cat.
your cat, nothing personal, but let's say you say, I don't believe in God, I hate God, there is no God, there is no interconnectedness among anyone, I just love my cat. Sorry, but that's not your case. You not only love your cat, she also loves her cat. But from a bigger picture, she's learning lessons from the cat, right? Or you were sharing, right? So if you love your cat from the bigger picture, Krishna comes to you even through the cat, interestingly enough. But again, the opposite many times is, and again, hopefully it doesn't sound to you as, now the sannyasi renounced guy is coming to the forefront. But if I love my cat only with me as the center, that's misdirected love. I call it love, I put the name, I take care of the cat, but in one way it's a form of extended selfishness. I only love what is mine. I know I love my car. I mean, I don't love my car, I don't have a car, I don't know how to drive, but I'm using the example. I love my car and I care for my car and I feel for my car, right? If you have your car, who has the car outside here? Jamuna. I say someone has destroyed your car. Jamuna is totally transcendent that she won't be affected. You can say but general people will freak out. And we're like, oof. Because there's so much identification with the car. Even if I say your car has been lost, and maybe you say, well, I'm lost. What's going on? No, you are not lost. You are here. The car is lost. But you are so enmeshed, your sense of being is so enmeshed with what you think you possess, that if something you think it's yours get lost, you feel you got lost. But it's a very narrow box. I love my car. Why? Because it's mine. Someone did something to my car, I go nuts. If someone did something to someone else's car, I don't care. But it's a car. But it's not my car. So the important word there is not car, it's my. This sense of mineness, I, me, mine, what we have in our tradition, right? I'm Ma Meti. My sense of I is derived from my sense of mine. What I think is mine. And that's my circle of possessiveness, belonging, and love, quote unquote. But then outside that circle, I don't care for anything. There's apathy, indifference, even hate, competition, jealousy, envy. So, how much can we call that love, right? We may call it love, but it's a very indirect version of it, so to say. So that's why I tried to write in the book, we need a definition of love that makes sense. Because if not in the name of love, we just do anything and everything. And everything is love. But we may be perpetrating self-separateness, self-centeredness. And self-centeredness is the womb of war. Because if I'm the center, and if I live my life as if I'm the center, and you do the same, and you do the same, and you do the same, and there can only be one center. We are constantly in competition and friction with one another. And I feel threatened by one another, and then I start to defend from one another, and they're gonna start to attack, and then you have individual friction, individual war, two people war, four people war, neighborhood, national, international, galactic. It has no limit. So, yeah, ideally, love has to acknowledge a common center. Commonality around which all revolve, whether you like to call that God or not. And that's why it's a gradual process for some people. I don't know, some people is really not condemning that. It's just, again, an ignorant, covert soul. Some people cannot think beyond themselves. It's all about themselves, all revolves around them. It all has to be in service to their perceived sense of being. Thomas Merton will say that means you are at the gateway of hell. When you see everything revolving around you, he will say that's hell. That's his definition of hell. Now, perceiving all of reality constellating around you. That's too much weight. You're not the center. So, and then our sense of love becomes a little more bigger. Okay, I not only love myself, I love my cat, me and my cat. Then I love my family, my husband, wife, whatever, my son. Then I love my neighbors. Then I love my extended family. Then I love my village. Then I love my country. Now, there are these senses of love. No, I give my life for the country, right? There's an identification and a sacrifice, the point of giving your life to that. And then it goes beyond the country. Let's love each other as human beings, as a race. Okay, then not only the race, human species, there are other species. Let's love that. Let's take care of Mother Earth, the whole planet. Why to limit that to one single planet? So there are, Sebastian Marsh will say, local interest, universal interest, local, provincial, universal. And he will say, you have to get to ride the universal wave. He will say, no, we have to. And again, we have to begin wherever we are. Most of us do not begin from universal love for all living entities. We may begin with a very, what to say? There's a word that is not coming. A very, anyhow, a very unrefined, undeveloped idea of love. But begin there and try to expand the circle. If it's all about me, can it be about me, about one more person? No? No, because it may be difficult for us to jump from absolute self-centeredness to unlimited, unconditional, universal love. So we may need to go to gradually extend our circle of care and love and kindness. And again, include more spaciousness, more capacity, train the muscle, love more. Love your enemy. Going back to the beginning of the conversation, to the point that nobody, nothing is left out of the equation, and again, you fall in love with the totality of reality. So yeah, that's love. That's divine love. I think it's an important clarification because sometimes divine love, again, many times we think divine love is me and Krishna. That's very limited. I'm happy that you include someone else apart from you. No? There are two guys, you and God. Okay, we are moving forward from only me. But still, there is much more. So, yeah. But we have to begin somewhere. And again, our traditions say a neophyte, a Kanishta Bhakta, is that person, no? Who loves God, but cannot understand that loving God deeply means loving everyone. Still, they cannot see that. But they have to begin somewhere, and that's a valid place to begin. Before that, probably they were not even loving God. They were not even considering, it's just all about me, and about me. I me mine, I me mine, I me mine. That's another song. Leonard Cohen, Bob Marley, George Harrison. To end on the devotional note. You know that song? All through the day, I'm in mine. Have to learn that one. It's a Beatles song, but George Harrison composed it. So all through the day, I'm in mine. It's like showing the trance of self-centeredness. So scriptures, okay, you are coming from that place. Let's be realistic. You cannot make the quantum leap to universal love. So let's move from I'm in mine, all through the day, I'm in mine, to Krishna and me, God and me. Okay, you're including one else in the equation, and that one else is a significant one. So there's reason to celebrate. You're a Kanishka Bhakta now. Jai. Oh, yeah, it's glorious in its own way. You're on the path. You're including God in the picture. If you are honest, it's as a matter of time that you just change your angle of vision to a broader picture. And then the Madhyam, the intermediate devotee, is like, just not God and me, but I acknowledge there are some other people also in reality, and I need to learn how to relate to them. And I become friends with devotees, and I become compassionate with those suffering, and I take some distance from those that I don't know how to handle. But it's interesting because in none of those cases it says I hate such and I hate that. It just says when I'm about to hate someone, I take a distance. No. So I can in that distance, and take a distance is not up a thin difference running away. Distance is I take enough distance so I can really understand that person that I was about to hate in close proximity. I feel I'm about to hate this person. Okay, I will take a distance. So I can get a bigger picture, and I do not end up hating, but I end up forgiving, understanding, whatever. That's Madhyam. And of course, there are in between stages between those two. All. And of course, then comes the Uttam, which is falling in love with the totality of reality. Uttam, the topmost seers, is like seeing God in everything, everything in God. You cannot not love anything. It's all lovable. It's all. You are absolutely into the tavern, as we were talking the other day. You are totally drunk in love of God, and everything is ecstatic. And the people who speak like that, those who are not as drunk as they are, they will say, these are crazy. It doesn't make any sense what they are saying. It's gone. No, it's like, look what's going on. No, everything is full of joy and love and this and that. And the other day I was reading Srila Siddhar Maharaj's Devotional Treasure Chest, I think was the name of the book, was in the room. He will say that there's one line in the 11th canto of the Bhagavad, and Krishna say, for those who have me always in their mind, sarva sukhamaya, everything is full of joy, always. And someone said, but look, this horror. And it's not that they are denying the horror, but they are still seeing beyond, piercing through that, and seeing still there is something more foundational behind all that. But again, that's the highest vision. We are not there, probably. But still, we can force to be there, but that vision has to be kept in mind so it becomes our sincere aspiration. So I every day I can have that as my north, so to say. Like, pole star. This is what I'm existing for. This is my potential, reminder of potential, daily reminder of all that you can be. And then going back to where you are and expanding the circle of love there. I don't know if that helps.
It's complex, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It's not just like this is it and this is not.
Yeah. It's
It's
paradoxical.
paradoxical.
You got it. Going back to
It's not a neat box.
yeah. As much as we need to think and speak about what love is, also we should equally careful if in never putting a conclusion to the discussion of love, because that's such a great temptation to bring things to a closure. This love, that's it. That's the worst crime on earth, right? To put an end to the discussion on love, to bring closure to a definition of love. That's not love. That's not loving to love. We have to keep the conversation open. And what does it mean to love in this day and time? What does it mean to be loving in the particular circumstance we are socio-politically in any given country, in any particular zeitgeist with its own unique qualities? It's so different with where we are now, what it means to be loving in the context of AI. There's so many things that this that all that can be part of the conversation of love. No, because I don't know. You relate to ChatGPT for a few moments, relate, and you can feel unconditionally accepted. No, I'm being true. If
Yes.
you are not trained in genuine unconditional human love, and you have zero experience of what it means to be seen for who you are and accepted, and you start to talk to ChatGPT for 5 minutes, and it's like, wow, nobody loved me like this lady. Or whomever, however, whatever name or identity, yeah. Right? So you can feel that's it, that's enough.
Problem
That
which
can
we
become a problem.
discuss.
So that's a discussion that we need to have now in this day and times, because that's there. And if we lack a genuine experience of human unconditional love, we may try to find that. And I'm not condemning those who go there. That in desperation never knew about that, but let's be honest, that's not a replacement for a genuine experience of unconditional love. So it
Sure.
can be tricky because if we do not preserve our humanity in proper and what it means to be human, lovingly human, the line starts to blur, and no, at one point we no longer know what it is. And if we as human become more and more inhuman, and technology becomes more and more human-like, we don't know what's what, and we may end up, so
But
that's now it.
you could learn also. I mean, that was my experience, you know, like just having an exchange with ChatGPT and seeing, wow, this is like, you know, better than a human in terms of how it's responding and acknowledging and all that. But what I thought in that moment is like, we could learn from there.
Yeah.
You know, because the ChatGPT is also getting the information from like different people, and like, you know, it's not just like developing that on its own, because there are people out there. That's what I thought. There are people out there who are like that, you know, kind and affectionate and all
Yeah.
of that. So.
It's a long conversation in terms of things developed on their own, in terms of algorithm and things. That's been,
Yeah,
we need
it's fantastic.
another UK retreat for that. But at the end of the day, and I've heard many, that's my conviction, of course, at the end of the day, and that of many others, that it will never reach a point that it can genuinely replace the experience you can have with another actual soul in front of you. Yeah. But we need to preserve our humanness to keep the difference clear. So as they have nowadays, I don't know, this forest preservation department, we have to have a human preservation department. So, that's one of the most valuable. I was listening to one author the other day. He's very much into all this. He said one of the most valuable assets to preserve in the near future is our humanity. Because and preserving doesn't mean just keeping it where it is, but it's again, you can only maintain something by making it grow, right? So, and what and a special quality of humanity is this capacity of loving in a genuinely selfless, in a good sense of the word, selfless way, and loving in a universal divine way. That's a trademark of human consciousness, of the soul in that particular vehicle. So we have a commitment to our potential, as I like to say. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premanand.